Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is a Bristol podcast, the first ever, and set up in 2002 and goes out every Friday afternoon at 2 o'clock on BCFM 93.2. Miscarriages of justice are growing in Britain in part due to the extinction of investigative TV documentaries such as the BBC's Rough Justice. But fear not, to the rescue comes Victims Unite website and the editor Sabine McNeil. Plus, this week we chat to Julian Parry about Britain's energy. But first, joining me on the line is Sabine McNeil from Victims Unite. Hi, Sabine.
Hi, Tony.
Now, you've been involved over the last couple of weeks with this case in Greenwich, looking at miscarriages of justice again. I don't know how you have the energy for it, but you're still at it. What's this case all about?
It is about the fact that one girl was adopted abroad, even though that was not supposed to happen, and the second girl was taken at birth, and that's what annoys me more than anything, because how can anybody kind of expect the risk of emotional harm or the risk of the inability of the mother not to take care of the child when she isn't even being given the chance? And if you dig into it, you find that the solicitor doesn't, when the woman found out about it and realized that the solicitor wasn't working in her interest, then he has a very, very, very hard time releasing his documents. The local authority doesn't release the documents. And it's just impossible, it seems, to get anywhere near justice. And what is supposed, certainly, in the interest of the child is just a complete farce. And, you just can't kind of... I can't take it anymore, in a way, without getting schizophrenic over it, because it's just so twisted and it's not right.
Well, no, I mean, I think, you know, there seems to be two levels of justice. All you need to do is look at the banks, isn't it? And you can see that many of the people who are involved in the crime of the LIBOR fixing, this is literally stealing billions of dollars, billions of pounds, have simply they've had no punishment whatsoever themselves. So this idea of two tiers of justice, is there anything that we can do about that? Because I know you're one of these people that advocates the idea that sometimes it's better not to have a solicitor and actually to be a litigant in person, to represent yourself in court.
Well, ironically, we have just opened offices with our partner organisation Help for Lips for litigants in person. And the website is help4lips.co.uk. But they also feel they basically just want to pass people on rather than, and help the system, change the system, rather than solve individual cases. And promptly I get at least two cases that I need to pass on to them where mediation is the answer. They have experience with mediation, which I do not have yet. I personally really think by now as well there is absolutely no point in going to court. You just don't get justice. It's a complete fantasy, complete illusion, and as you say, there is one law for them and one non-law for us. And the family courts are just the worst. So besides mediation, I don't really see an avenue forward and helping people come to terms with whatever has happened to them.
Now, you talked a bit about disclosure just now, that is to say the local authorities releasing documents so that they can be used against them in court. Obviously, you know, this also might come under the Freedom of Information Act. Particularly social services are quite clearly going to be reluctant to hand over documents when they actually incriminate them.
Yes, I mean, I have yet to see more people taking social services to court, that, quite frankly, and I think it's like the victims of paedophilia who are too weak in the end to take their abusers on in the same way. I know of one case where two boys got compensation after they've been moved around in foster care 19 times, I think, but the system is there to grind people down and to abuse them. This one woman whom I saw in Holloway who was in 13 foster homes and who had 4 children taken at birth I mean, why was she not given a chance to be a mother? It's clearly a kind of a machinery to process people, and including that their children, and use them. So
the thing is, hang on a minute though, because I mean, you have to remember things like the case of Baby P. Baby Peter, obviously, was later revealed, where it was clear that was an abusive household, that very, very young children were being abused. Now, if that lady had another child, you wouldn't want that child to go straight into an abusive situation.
That's true, but John Hemming MP says very clearly social services get involved when they shouldn't, and they don't get involved when they should. And I have, of course, only come across those cases which upset me and the parents.
But I mean, hang on, because also I'm getting you to hang on quite a bit here, but you know, you've also got the situation that when social services do their job properly, that is to say, you know, take away a child that is in an abusive household, that there's no song and dance about it. Nobody talks about it, just because they are doing their job. It's the focus is on when things go wrong.
Yes, it's of course true. It's all secret, secret, secret. But when things go wrong, I mean, 1,000 kids taken a month. And then, I mean, Vicky Hake put into prison again because she was in a pub and set up to talk about her daughter. And she has only one visit a week. And that's not social services. That's the judiciary, which I've seen always colluding and covering up what social services are doing. And believe you me, Tony, I'm not alone. If you look at Facebook, where people are talking about their stories, local authorities, yes, they deny and lie and they cover up. No, they don't. They don't disclose. And I have seen a letter in another case where the social services or the legal team claim that the woman has been legally represented when she plainly hasn't. I mean, deny and lie and commit a crime and cover up. That is sort of the bottom line that I've discovered.
Now, one of the things that I think is really important always to try and do with these shows, Sabine, is to give people a bit of an indication is if they are not necessarily trusting of a solicitor, how do you actually get to find a solicitor that is good for you and that you can trust? Because this is an ongoing problem, is it? You put your entire future and sometimes your home and everything into the hands of one person. You need to make sure you can trust that person, because sometimes the system for actually weeding out bad solicitors simply doesn't work.
That's for sure. I mean, I don't know how many cases I can quote where they say the solicitors are the problem, and there wouldn't be a website solicitorsforhell.net if solicitors were clean and were doing their job after all. The woman who phoned me today, it happens to be a family case where her ex-husband hasn't paid maintenance, but in the process she has uncovered all sorts of white-collar criminals as well. And so all I could tell her, look, winning your case is one issue, exposing white-collar criminals is another. I kind of focus on the latter, because nobody else does it as much, if you like, and because I like giving a voice to victims. But the choice, I mean, in this process, I'm trying to help victims and to try and find a family lawyer who would take on a woman in prison has been completely unsuccessful. I have not succeeded. I went to see them and I liked them and I thought one could work with them, then all of a sudden they say I'm not, one of them said I don't represent her anymore, even though the woman still had not disinstructed her. And the other one said, no, she can't take him on. And quite lately also, no, they can't take on. I don't know why.
Okay, Sabine. Well, maybe we'll discover over future weeks some of the answers to these questions. Thank you very much for joining us today. Your website, of course, is victims-unite.net.
Thank you, Tony. Thank you for believing in me and my website.
Okay, no problem. BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community. Well, now I'm joined by Julian Parry, who's a businessman from Somerset. Julian, you're here to talk about energy tonight. Why are you so concerned about energy? I mean, I know the one connection I can think of with energy in Somerset is the plans to pour chemicals into the Mendips in order to get gas out of them. Apparently, if you pour the chemicals down into the ground, the rock reacts with the chemicals and some kind of gas comes out.
Well, hello, and thank you for inviting me. Yes, you're right. What you're talking about, of course, is fracking, which is the fracturing of the rock at very deep levels, possibly 10,000 feet deep, whereupon, having got to that level, the frackers then bore sideways and then inject water with sand, and they claim one chemical, although I suspect it's an awful lot of chemicals that are bound together as one chemical, and that is put down there at pressure. The rock is fractured. This releases gases, and those gases are supposed to come up the pipe to be distributed for general use, for which, of course, the general public will pay handsomely. There is, of course, a problem, is that when you're getting the gases out, they don't all come up the pipe. The rock fractures in a myriad of ways that one cannot predict wholly accurately, and for those who have seen the Gaslands film, you can see the sight of gases coming up out of the ground through the little streams and being lit on the surface. So you have flames dancing like a will-o'-the-wisp, and that is methane coming out. Now here's a very strange question. Governments these days are always on about carbon dioxide being a greenhouse gas. Many years ago, a scientist known as Rode produced a paper which showed that methane was also a greenhouse gas, but 21 times as effective as carbon dioxide. So on the one hand, governments are terribly worried about carbon dioxide being put into the atmosphere, and yet they don't seem to care about methane being released on a vast scale in a completely uncontrolled fashion.
Well, now hang on a minute, Julian, because the idea is to capture this methane and to actually turn it into fuel gas that is then sold onto the public.
That's the idea, but of course, and much of it will be, but of course, when you put pipes into the ground and you fracture the ground, how do you tell a molecule of gas to go this way or that if it is inclined to climb up by its own most direct route? The truth of the matter is you cannot control that physically, therefore you cannot regulate it, therefore they are going to allow an unregulatable practice that will, in the end, poison the earth.
Now, we've just seen this week awards given to many of the conscripts in the Second World War who were sent down coal mines to mine coal for the war effort, that being seen as almost as much as an essential war service as fighting on the front. Back in the 1940s, we were almost entirely reliant on coal for our energy. We've come a long way since then, and we're now, it seems, reliant on things like wind power, because that doesn't pollute the environment so much as coal, and things like wave energy, all this kind of, you know, alternative energies, plus of course nuclear. Now it's all in the balance a little bit at the moment, whether nuclear is going to be affordable or not into the future, whether that will be part of the solution. But surely any kind of new type of energy that can be harnessed from Britain's own territory, that we don't have to buy in from abroad, is a good thing.
There's a great deal of difference between mining coal and fracking gas. Fracking gas involves taking up technologies in the ground which are not as controllable as they would be if you're using normal technologies in coal mining. You do and will get random dispersal of methane in a way which is threatening, until one day there's a huge accident which we might call its Fukushima moment. And as we all know from the nuclear industry, it had its Fukushima moment, which led Japan and Germany to say enough of nuclear power. Although in Britain, they don't seem to want to take any notice of that. They want to go ahead with fracking. And in the end, we will have a big bang. And that big bang could happen in the Mendips.
So what about energy policy more generally? If you were Secretary of State for Energy, what would you be looking at as a long-term future for supplying our energy needs? Because it seems that every way that society tries to turn, that there are people opposing it. I mean, there's a lot of opposition to vast wind farms, understandably, marring the countryside. I mean, although I don't seem to remember so much of a protest about power pylons when they were first put up, obviously also doing a similar thing. And a similar thing with nuclear energy. A lot of people are saying that that is simply not sustainable long term because of the waste, the nuclear waste, which stays radioactive for hundreds of thousands, if not millions of years.
Well, that's very true. And of course, the other thing about the nuclear industry is that it uses uranium in a very inefficient manner. A far more efficient reactor is a salt thorium reactor, which the nuclear community has turned its back on, but would produce a byproduct with a 300-year time scale for it being poisonous, which is manageable, whereas the wastes out of the new Hinkley project will last for 10,000s of years and will never decay. There is a problem that we don't know how to handle. Whereas there is another way, method for producing energy, which I've helped invent, which is using ordinary municipal waste as the fuel. Now, you will have heard of incinerators. Not a good idea. Mass burning metals with plastics.
Well, we've just got one that's opened here on Avonmouth, haven't we, an incinerator? And apparently we hear this week that waste will be being carted down, probably on the train, from London to be incinerated here, just west of us, which I suppose is going to be, is just upwind of Bristol, isn't it?
Well, of course, there was a time a couple of years ago when the council voted the incinerator down, but the incinerator lobby just keeps on trucking, and you're not going to stop them. But the real problem is that they're burning metals with plastics, with other waste, and that is a very bad idea because it produces furans and dioxins. And really and truthfully, you need a system which separates out the metals from the plastics, from the organic fraction, before it's burned, and that's the technology I invented, and it's called the Joint Technology Protocol.
Tell us a bit about that then, because it sounds like almost from heaven, this wonderful system where all you need to do is put all your waste into Julian's factory and you've got all the energy you need and no pollution.
That's absolutely right. And the way you do it is you collect it in a trailer behind an electric tug. You don't send out all those heavy vehicles crushing it. You put it into the plant with an injector lorry, and you autoclave it, which strips all the paint, all the paper, reduces all the forest product to a mush that we call a flock.
Okay, what is an autoclave?
An autoclave is a very large machine that can apply vacuum as well as applying steam pressure. And because it applies steam pressure for a couple of hours, it means that everything that goes in there, 20 tons at a time, is sterilized. And therefore, we don't have any problems over what's known as the animal byproducts order. And it's safe for the workers. You take that material out of there, you then put it across the materials recycling facility, which separates it all out, and it separates out the organic fraction, the flock. The flock is then put into huge silos, treated in a certain way, and we found a way of drying it without using heat. And that turns it into a fuel, which can then be put into the Suksei burners, which produce electricity at 54% efficiency. And that's how such a system, if we built one to manage 1.36 million people, costing about £400 million, £300 a head, it would in fact produce enough electricity for one third of the population. Not only that, it would pay for itself in 3 to 5 years. And if the councils built it and clubbed together, well, guess what? You could take a third off council tax ever afterwards.
Well, sounds like an amazing solution, but I mean, you would say that, wouldn't you? Because you're peddling this as a product that you're going to make money out of yourself, Julian.
Well, I've spent 20 years trying to bring this to public attention and trying to bring it to the minister's attention, and all you meet is a blank wall. So I've more or less given up on it, although they are looking at it in Israel at the moment. So we'll see what happens.
Energy policy generally, if you just leave your incinerator aside, where should we be looking at the various different types of energy? If fracking is not going to work, I mean, we've got two serious problems with that. One is the pollution of the environment generally, That is to say methane leaching out, this kind of thing, and possible earthquakes. The other, possibly more worrying, is the pollution of the water supply from these chemicals used in fracking.
Quite right.
So if we just leave that one aside for a moment as well, what do you think we should be investing our efforts into? What are the old, maybe older technologies that should be revived now to provide energy for the nation?
Well, there are a number of technologies out there, and of course solar voltaics is one of them, where you see these devices appearing on roofs all over the country, and they're not a bad idea. The only problem we're going to have is when they fade away in 25 years' time, as they were run out of steam, because, you know, they do decay and have to be replaced. The fact of the matter is that we could then be in trouble with oil supplies, and how are we going to replace them? So that's one. The next one will be coal energy, which we would have to sink completely new mines. You can't reopen old ones. That would take a great deal of effort. And of course, as John Gross puts out in his paper, The Econotechnic Future, without diesel oil and with diminishing supplies of oil, you're going to have difficulty opening up coal mines on a big, and operating them on a large enough basis to sustain us in the future. So coal can play its part, but don't let's be too over-reliant. Wind, for every dollar you put in the ground, you get $6 or $7 out, whereas every dollar you put in the ground with oil, you get $200 out. That shows you the difference in the economics, which is material to the case. Wave energy, very, very expensive, yet to be developed. I have some hopes for undersea windmills, because there the power is much greater, and that's a technology that I'm pleased to see people beginning to produce.
Well, Bristol Channel's got one of the biggest tidal reaches in the world, hasn't it? I mean, that seems an obvious one to tap somehow. Tidal energy.
Yeah, tidal energy, that's quite right. And of course there, you're quite right, it's the second highest tide in the world, and it's a 14-metre tide. It's absolutely huge. The point is that people do have fears that blocking it would upset the balance, the eco balance in the estuary. I have a friend who knows an awful lot about the estuary, who says that you put a dam across there, and it may be that Weston enjoys blue seas, as the energy and the entropy required to keep all that mud afloat in the water actually subsides, and we would no longer have the Cappuccino Sea, as it's known locally. But there are others who say, well, no, what we would prefer to see are lagoons, because of fish flows and all the other things, and fish getting mashed up in veins. And, you know, there are a number of arguments. But one of the things I do know is that Dr. Shaw was running experiments on this in Woodland Road at the University of Bristol 30 years ago. And it is a shame that more serious efforts are not put into actually putting this barrage in place in one form or another. Of course, there are two potential sites for it. One is on Breen Down, the other is beyond Minehead, and there are arguments there as to which is best as well.
What about something a bit smaller scale, you know, sort of just maybe, for example, the Avon River, the estuary there, because having something that goes right across to, you know, across to Wales is a massive barrage, a massive you know, interruption of the natural environment.
It is, that's quite right, which is why some people are calling for lagoons, so that they fill up on the sides as the tide comes in and then discharge, but they don't impede the actual main river flow. And maybe they've got a point.
Julian Parry, thanks very much.
Thank you.
BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Well, now I'm joined by Jeff Barr from the Southwest branch, if you can call it that. At least he's a campaigner in the Southwest, to do with a campaign called Keep Our NHS Public. Hi, Jeff, and welcome to Dialect. Now, tell us a little bit about what is going on with the health service at the moment.
Well, the big thing was the act that went through last year, and it is progressively designed to open the health service to massive private competition, to sell our services to private profiteers. And that's the major problem facing us.
Who are these companies?
Well, a number of them are big American firms, like United Health, Hospital Corporation of America, which runs in Britain. There's Circle, there's a whole number of private firms, and of course there's Serco that has been notoriously inefficient in providing out-of-hours services in Cornwall.
But what's the problem if these companies can provide the same service for less money?
That would be good, but they don't. They provide it for more money. If you look at admin as a percentage of the total cost of the system, that gives you a good guide to how efficient it is. Before we started privatising in 1980, it was 5% of the total. By 10 years ago, it had gone up to 13%. It's expected to go up to 18%. So the percentage of money spent just on admin, pushing paper and all of that sort of stuff, goes up massively when you privatise.
Now, the health service began after the Second World War, and the idea was basically that people had been being sort of pulled out from underneath buildings as part in, during the war, and people felt that actually it didn't really make sense to be asking people, you know, have you got health insurance at that point? You know, it was a kind of callous thing, and everyone had to be treated. And it was seen that there was a kind of, it was a kind of levelling approach to have everybody treated the same. How has the politics changed since World War II to now, Jeff, you know, to do with the way the health service is run?
Yeah, it's the Thatcher Revolution brought marketisation to just about everything. Thatcher was a bit worried about doing it to the NHS, so it's moved rather slowly. But this present government has raced ahead with it, but it doesn't actually do us any good. The people who are advising them are the American corporations, and of course they're notoriously inefficient. They spend about twice as much on health care as us, and they get poorer results. It's a terrible system that we're moving towards.
Yeah, but why? Why is it happening like this? I mean, surely the government here, we've elected them to run our country for the best way for us, but it seems that that isn't necessarily happening with the health service.
I think that's exactly true. Neither of the governing parties proposed these policies. Michael Portillo, a former Tory minister and indeed candidate for the leadership, pointed out that if they'd put this in their manifestos, they would have lost. They've snuck this through the back door, and frankly, it's outrageous what they're doing. I don't think there's any mandate for it. I don't think there's any support for it, but there are big bucks in it. You'll see ministers having close relationships with these private companies.
Now, I know you're, am I right in thinking you're a governor of a hospital down there in Exeter, is that right?
I am, I'm a governor of the Royal Devon and Exeter Hospital.
Now, what reaction have you seen in your particular hospital that you're a governor of, you know, in the hospital itself and also amongst other governors?
The hospital itself is having to save a massive $17 million a year. Year on year on year, and that is putting big pressure on it. As you know, they set up a consortium of hospitals in the southwest with a view to cutting pay and worsening working conditions. When I stood as a governor, I stood to oppose that, and I still do vigorously oppose it at every opportunity. I think the other governors are a group with a variety of different views. They don't necessarily agree with me, unfortunately, but I think many of them are beginning to see the problems in this kind of change of policy that the government's implementing.
So where is this $17 million annual cut year on year? I mean, that's a massive amount, surely. I mean, I don't know how much your budget here is, but our two trusts here in Bristol have something like $1,000 million. That's a billion annual budget. Now, even $17 million a year on year off that is a massive cut in real terms.
Yeah, it is. Ours isn't as big as that, but it's a pretty substantial budget, and it is a big burden on them, which I think is why in their desperation they turn to these very foolish proposals of worsening staff conditions. But they're expected to raise it by some magical efficiency payment, but when most of the costs of a hospital are in the staff, it can't easily be done.
Jeff, what can people do? Because quite clearly the National Health Service is one of the greatest institutions created in the history of humanity, really, looking after people no matter what their income is or their social status. Everybody's equal under the NHS, and if they want to, they can go outside, they can go private if they wish to, but the National Health Service is always there to pick up people who fall on ill health and you know, can't afford to pay for it.
Indeed. The first thing to do, I would obviously advise, is join KeepAir NHS Public. Now, the easiest way to find it is to put into Google KONP and you'll find it. Or to the other organisation very worthy of support is 38 Degrees, which has campaigned on health and on a number of other issues. I would also urge people to get active locally. Join your local health hospital trust. Join your patient's participation group at your ordinary doctor's practice. They're being set up all over the country now. You can join, you can have your say.
Ultimately, do you think this is going to go through, and how long is it going to take for the NHS to actually be no longer free at the point of delivery for those patients that need it?
Well, it's creeping in, and we've got to fight it every inch of the way. I'm not defeatist about this. I think millions of people are on our side. What we have against us is big money and a government that has frankly betrayed us. If you look at the coalition agreement, you'll see it says nothing about this, nothing at all. So that I think we do have to battle it, and I think we can defend the NHS and we can advance and improve it.
What confidence have you got in the current management of the health service? Because there was a, I think his name is David Nicholson, I'm not absolutely sure, but he was somebody who really protected wrongdoing, it seems, in Staffordshire, and then he was promoted to be the head of the National Health Service, and he's still there. He refuses to resign, even though it's been exposed what he's done in the past.
I think it's scandalous that he's refused to go. I think there are problems at the top of the NHS, but I think the most positive thing is to take advantage of the democratic opportunities and make sure that we, the ordinary members of the public, have our say. And I think that's the best defence of the health service, and it's the best way to improve it. It has been a very good service. It has very high levels of trust compared, if you take comparisons with America, where our doctors are considered trustworthy by 92% of the public. I don't know about the other 8%. American doctors are only considered trustworthy by 64% because they're so tied up with the market, and people are thinking, is he saying this because I need it or because he can make money out of it? And we certainly don't want that here.
In your hospital, what's morale like, Jeff?
It's patchy, but in many areas it has been brought down by this fear that pay may be cut and conditions of work worsened. But it is a struggle when you have a government which is so unsympathetic to the very hard work that a lot of nurses and doctors do. I know many of them personally, and many of the people are rather fearful.
But do they see that it's something that, that the people of the country, that ultimately, you know, we will be able to preserve the health service? Something that, you know, I certainly, many others are very proud of, that we can boast of. You know, this is something that Britain has achieved over the centuries. Despite, you know, lots of naughty things that the British Empire has done, Britain finally managed to achieve this, you know, but it seems like it may be soon going.
Well, it is under threat. It is under threat, and we do need a movement. That's why I'm urging people to join and to participate.
Okay, so whereabouts do we find you on the internet? Have you got phone numbers or things for those that aren't on the net too?
KeepAir NHS Public is the key area to go to. That's the first and most important thing. And KONP website is the most obvious place, but that's the key to it. But to keep our NHS public, you'll find us on the web, you'll find us in various other places as well, and you'll also find 38 Degrees, which is mostly on the web. It's not much anywhere else.
But actually, what about for people who aren't online?
People who aren't online, the best thing they can do is get in touch with me. My number is Are you ready? 01392 433 3365.
Okay, can you just read that one again?
Yep. 01392 433 3365.
Well, Jeff Barr from, well, you're also Governor of a Hospital in Exeter and from Keep Air NHS Public in the South West. Thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Well, thank you.
BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Now I'm joined by Jason Yannakopoulos, who's come into the studio as usual, grasping a copy of Private Eye. What we got this week, Jason?
We got a very interesting story. It's great news for people with disabilities. In fact, it's amazing news. Atos have managed successfully to fall foul of disability discrimination laws.
So they're actually being prosecuted, are they?
Yes. In fact, not just being prosecuted, have been prosecuted.
Okay, so who's managed to do that? Tell us about it.
This is...
What were they caught up to?
This is David Johnson, who was summoned to an Atos assessment. David was summoned to an Atos assessment, and this is very interesting because he found that the assessment centre wasn't disability-friendly. Ironically.
So he was going for an actual assessment, but he found it difficult to get in. Did he actually manage to get in?
I mean, but suffered considerable pain and fatigue after he turned up for an assessment at an inaccessible centre. Now, Atos replied to he complained by letter to Atos, and Atos replied that it was not bound by disability discrimination laws because they apply to public bodies.
Oh, so that was a good way of getting out of it, Department of Work and Pensions, wasn't it?
As it turned out, it wasn't a good enough excuse. And this, it doesn't apply because they claimed that the law about having to make reasonable adjustments didn't apply because it was providing medical examination services to the Department of Work and Pensions for profit rather than providing public service. However, Mr. Johnson's claim was supported by the Equality and Human Rights Commission.
Well, it just goes to show, doesn't it? If you think you're being messed around by ATOS, don't have a chat to your local solicitors. I mean, probably somewhere like the Avon and Bristol Law Centre, you know, ones that are supported by various charitable organisations and also that do legal aid. And they, you see, then, as in this case, can actually get bigger fish involved in your case if they think that it's worth doing. So someone actually turned up to do their disabled assessment and found it actually quite difficult to get into the building.
Well, yeah,
and then they've picked that up and they've run with it to a big national story.
Brilliant. It's actually worthwhile to us because... records from Department of Work and Pensions show that 25 centres lack wheelchair access, 62 have no parking or disabled parking facilities, and 33 have no public transport facilities nearby.
Well, I suppose it means that disabled people are going to have to get taxis, does it?
It would seem so, which is, it's interesting depending on where you are. Some places, I mean, we've had interesting issues here with us in the past, which... certainly Disability Awareness Network at UWE will be looking into when they restart again next year.
Now, you weren't with us last week. Where were you?
I was in London attending an Equality and Diversity Forum meeting from the National Equality and Diversity Forum. That was very interesting. It was about equality issues in higher education, particularly relating to international students. And obviously I covered today, obviously covered a bit of disabled students, and we found some really interesting stuff in there about sort of dodgy stuff with the higher education system, such as the fact that if you're an international student, the amount you pay it's not standardised.
So don't tell me, look, if you're from Saudi Arabia, you have to pay double what someone from Bangladesh has to pay. Is that what we're talking about?
Yeah, I mean, there's a list of countries which are considered at risk. So, you know, considered risk countries. So, you know, there's Saudi Arabia. Brazil, funnily enough, is on that list, which is really interesting.
When they say at risk, does that mean that the universities think they might not actually get their money?
I don't know. It's interesting because once on there, Brazil, China, Iraq, Iran, Saudi Arabia, it's... very intriguing. I don't know what it meant by that. The actual guy doing who mentioned that was the NUS International Students Officer, who is himself Brazilian.
Right, so he was dishing his own country in the dirt, really, by saying that.
Well, he was making a point that it's not equal across each country. It's, and actually, the problem that international students face at university is that they is the amount they pay isn't standardised. Even if they're doing like a 3-year term, they could be playing so much 1 year and then paying a lot more the following year. And actually, we then got into discussing problems for international students with disabilities, who may have an assessment that isn't recognised by the government, and so they have to shell out more to get a proper assessment done. And then there may be a point, I put this to all the members of the panel, and another knew the answer to this. I said, I asked them, would they actually have to reapply every year to get their funding? You know, would they have to go through the test every year? You know, it's and nobody knew the answer. So that's that was really intriguing.
Okay, this what was it again? You said it quite quickly, the conference that you went to. What was it again?
It was it's Equality and Diversity Forum conference in King's College London. It actually had a title, but I can't remember what the title was off the top of my head.
Okay, so what is this organisation, and what different types of people are represented there?
Well, just not everyone's represented on that. I mean, Equality and Diversity Forum represents minorities in the UK. So, and that's all minorities. So that is based on race, gender, disability, sexual orientation, age, even things like social background. It's.
I mean, do you feel? I mean, certainly the way that disabled people are being treated at the moment. Do you feel like, in a way, the government's paying lip service to this diversity? Because, you know, the idea that I mean, certainly if someone's able-bodied, they're not being targeted at all, but with all this disability stuff, being called in, checked, often told that you're not disabled even when they are, and bullied. Able-bodied people aren't going through this, whereas disabled people are. That seems like discrimination
it's discrimination. And I mean, it's absolutely shocking. One of the things that I found really interesting was the Equality Diversity Forum. They were talking about how they work with the Equality Challenge Unit, and they've tackled
who are they? The Equality Challenge Unit.
Yeah, they're a higher education group. They look at sort of equality within higher education, and they said that they look at everything individually. And I said, you don't look at sort of like crossings, such as somebody who's an international student and disabled. They admit that, but it's amazing some of the work they've done, because I've seen the Equality and Challenge Unit's work, and they actually collect data and publish fair data all across the board, and it's really interesting. But the point you were making about there being disabled people discriminated against is actually covered by the Equality and Diversity Forum. You made a point about this, that not everyone has to go in for this just in case they've got a hidden disability. I mean, it's something that I advise any 18-year-old to do before they go to university is get a checkup and an assessment, and I would have done that before the current government, because that's what I had to do before I went to university.
One of the things I've noticed is that, you know, the new Cabot Circus, most of the crossings in, you know, Britain now have got these little things that bleep, right, when the light the green man comes on, you know, to help people who are blind to see they can't see what's going on, they can hear what's going on, okay to cross now, you know, they've got those little knobbly bits on the side of the pavement.
I think that's brilliant, actually. Yeah, that's
but,
really
but my point I'm trying to make is that at Cabot Circus they don't do it. The brand new ones just outside Cabot Circus. It's one of those things that, as an able-bodied person, you don't always notice. But if you're trying to cross the road at Cabot Circus, there is no bleep. There's just a nice little green man. But so if you're blind, you need to have your guide dog and someone help you.
I think Bristol City Council need to have a look at that. I mean, I heard Bristol City Council take a look at that, because that is shocking. You know, it's.
I mean, it's been there for, what, is it 2 or 3 years now, Cabot Circus, and nobody seems to have done anything about it. I'm just surprised that, you know, anyone can get away with putting new crossings in without those sorts of basic things for disabled people.
I mean, I think that's absolutely shocking. I have to say, you know, there are some improvements I've seen. Some of the buses I've got on recently have had a thing on saying, you know, your next stop is, blah, 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 your next stop is, blah, 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 but not all of them have it. So, you know,
it's potluck, isn't it?
Oh. It is potluck, and I think it's one of those things. And it's not just it's not just people with disability, but also anyone who doesn't know their way around Bristol. Yeah. You know, particularly.
So you may have to actually go up and speak to a human being, i.e., the bus driver. Of course, in the old days, you used to go and talk to the clippy, you know, the conductor.
But they don't have conductors anymore.
They've abolished those right across the country. All right, Jason. Anything more from Private Eye this week?
Not essentially. No.
Okay. All right. Well, maybe some more next week. Jason Yannakopoulos, thanks very much for joining us.
Pleasure.
BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Well, now I'm joined by Paul Fernie again. Paul, we're going to take a little break from our trip around the solar system and the universe this week and look at Moonbase. Now, this is something we were chatting about a little bit last week, which was the demise of the space program. You know, us as youngsters, there was a big excitement with the Apollo and everything, and it was all great excitement. But it starts to look as if really all that was an attempt to, you know, get domination of space so they could put these various military satellites up in space. I hate to be cynical, but that's what it seems. But it seems that at least somebody on planet Earth is looking at actually having a permanent base on the moon and not necessarily using it to sight rockets there or something.
Yeah, it's it seems that in a sort of old school, a classic Cold War style, the big players in the current moon base plans are the US and Russia. However, unlike the 50s and 60s, it appears that Russia is now being spurned on by the US. Originally, Russia sought to join a US plan to establish a moon base in 2024, but according to the head of the Russian Space Agency, the Americans rebuffed that offer. There's also a couple of other players, China and Japan. They have designs on getting astronauts onto the moon by the middle of the next decade.
Now, I'm being a bit cynical. Are they just after some sort of minerals to claim the moon as their own so they can mine it for their own personal profit?
Yeah, I don't know if that's being a bit cynical. Although, as with all things, I think there's a little bit of ownership issues going on here. You know, first there gets ownership and all this sort of thing, though technically the Americans got there in the late 60s.
Have they still got their flag sitting up there?
Apparently so.
First mission of the Russians is going to be to trundle their little moon rover over and grab their flag, I suppose.
Yeah, remove that American flag and replace it, yeah. I mean, that's, of course, if you don't go for the old conspiracy theories about a film set in America somewhere. But we'll cover that another time.
All right, so what is going to be the purpose of this moon base then?
Really, it comes down to this same principle. It's about advancing humankind, getting us some sort of establishment on another body in the solar system. In this case, it's a moon. Can't call it a planet. You know, Mars... There's this big thing about Mars at the moment. Mars is a long way away. There's a lot of issues around power... you know, the power systems they'll use to get there. You know, if you go there, is it a one-way trip, etc.? You know, so the moon's a lot easier. It's a lot nearer. If there's problems, you can get back a lot quicker. And, you know, again, it's about advancing technology and national pride, of course. We'll come into it somewhere along the line.
Okay, so when is it actually going to happen?
Well, between the Americans seem to have a design on 2024. The Russians are looking at 2025 for a manned flight with an inhabited station between 2027 and 2032.
So the Americans, again, are going to try and get there first. And I mean, is there any kind of collaboration, or do the Americans just reject that and they say, oh, we want to do it separately?
Yeah, there's a private player in the American plan, a company called Bigelow, and they're the ones designing the sort of space station pods. So obviously there's sort of private enterprise interest going on with this as well, and obviously Americans have, for whatever reason, they've rebuffed their offer to the Russians to help along.
But aren't they going to go nuts, people who are staying up there for months and months, if not years on end?
You know, I've mentioned this before with regard to sort of space travel and stuff. You know, physically our bodies can cope with it. We've got the technology to go up there for a long time. But I don't know if mentally, psychologically, as humans, we're really cut out for that sort of amount of time with the same people or even in isolation. I think, yeah, we'd go nuts.
Okay, Paul. Okay, we'll do what we were supposed to do this week. That is Mars.
Yep.
Next week.
Absolutely.
Cheers.
Thanks, Tony.
BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Now it's Jeffrey. Jeff Sparks with the What's On Guide.
Thank you, Tony. Hello, this is your What's On Guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday 10th of May, The Twang and also Cast will be co-headlining at the O2 Academy in Frogmore Street, Bristol. Tickets are £16 in advance and doors open at 6:30 p.m. Also on 10th of May, UK Subs will be performing with support from Dragster at the Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Tickets are £10 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. On to Song of the Week, and I present Bunker Hill. He was born David Walker on May the 5th, 1941, and in the late 50s, he started singing gospel and joined the Sensational Wonders, who changed their name to the Mighty Clouds of Joy. Then in 1962, it all changed for him, and he recorded The Girl Can't Dance, along with Link Ray and the Ray Men as his backing band, and the song was released in 1963. So here we are, this is Bunker Hill with The Girl Can't Dance.
She's mine, all mine. You know now everybody knowing mama girl can dance. She's mine, all mine. Well, when she can dance, she can show her own man. But what you say about a mother don't need a thing. Hey, everybody knowing mama girl can dance. She's mine, all mine. You know now everybody knowing mama girl can twist. She's mine, all mine. You know now everybody knowing mama girl can twist. She's mine, all mine. Well, when she can twist, she got your own. The boys when I kiss her, I got a joint pimp. Everybody talking about a girl can dance. She's mine, all mine. You know not everybody talking about a girl ain't cute. She's mine, all mine. You know not everybody talking about a girl ain't cute. She's mine, all mine. Well, when she ain't cute, she don't belong to you. The Lord don't please, the fly through the booty. Everybody talking about a girl ain't cute. She's mine, all mine.
That was Bunker Hill with The Girl Can't Dance, which was released in 1963. Moving into Saturday, 11th of May, Cast Off Kinks, which feature Mike Avery, the original drummer of the Kinks, will be performing at the Tunnels in Bristol and Exeter Mews, Bristol. Tickets are £12.50 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. Finally, on Sunday, 12th of May, Sharks will be performing with support from Bleach Blood at the Croft in Stokes Croft, Bristol. Tickets are £7 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. That's all from me. Thanks for listening and have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you, Jeff. That's all for this week. Dialect is a weekly podcast for your MP3 player, produced by volunteers and broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 2 p.m. every Friday afternoon. If you're online, you can subscribe to our RSS feed or email list, which will remind you every Tuesday evening when Dialect goes online. You can do that or download this weekly podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our studio guests this week. That's Julian Parry and Jeff Barr from Keep Our NHS Public. Dialect is a Bristol Broadband Co-op production and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, do contact us please through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733. That's 0117 989 7733. And you'll find them on the internet at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. That was Dialect and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening, and so until the same time next week, goodbye.